I'm Sarah. I'm one of the editors of Triple Canopy. We're an editorial collective and a magazine. This is Speculations, The Future Is. It's our contribution to Expo One at PS1. We have a calendar of events that you can grab across the hall. Tomorrow we have a number of artists who are actually in Expo One, a show within a show called Pro Bio. So Josh Klein, along with Alyssa Berenbaum and others, will be here tomorrow talking about their work. And on Sunday, we'll have Kathy Weeks in conversation with Alex Gurevich about the politics of work. But today, I'm very pleased to welcome Karn Ross, who is a former British diplomat. His most recent book is The Leaderless Revolution, which draws on his experience as a diplomat and describes how governments are failing to address our most urgent problems, including inequality and economic volatility, climate change and terrorism. And instead of looking to authority, the book offers an inspiring message of empowerment and self-organized action, anarchism for the 21st century. Karn is also a founder and executive of Independent Diplomat, which advises democratic but marginalized governments and political groups so that their views are heard internationally. And Karn was also involved with Occupy Wall Street, where he helped to facilitate the alternative banking group. And so please join me in welcoming him today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. So very foolishly, I should have done this. Oh, no, it's done. I had the option of leaving it there, but I felt that would make me very static, so I'm just going to kind of wander up and down, which is my normal mode of speaking. I have to comment that it's a rather extraordinary room. It's slightly distracting. I'm slightly overwhelmed by its kind of lines and that sort of destroyed bell up there, and sort of craning my neck backwards to see you in the audience. So forgive me if I'm slightly discombobulated as I try to explain my speculation for the future, which is a really wonderful thing to be asked to talk about. I've never been asked to talk about it before, and it's a really great joy to be asked to talk about that. Because normally I talk about everything that's wrong and what might be put right about it. But even for me, that's getting pretty tedious because I think we kind of all know what is wrong. We certainly feel it, even if we can't necessarily articulate it. A crisis in democracy, a crisis in late-stage capitalism, it goes under many forms. But one of the odd things about thinking about the future is that it seems a rare exercise these days. We seem to have lost the desire or the will or perhaps even the ability to think creatively about the future. When one thinks back to the 50s or 60s and the extraordinary kind of paintings and imaginings of a kind of wonderful sort of future with jet cars and space rockets and everybody racing around in hovercraft, one doesn't see that so much anymore. And instead, popular culture seems to be populated by a much more dystopian vision of our future, such as the movie Oblivion, which I went to see the other day, which I recommend, and The Walking Dead, which is the only TV series I watch, and I love it. But it's a very dystopian view of the future. It's very scary. So thank you, Triple Canopy, for asking me to speak about the future. It's my privilege. But I have to start by saying that my thinking is actually impelled by a very dystopian view of the future, which is that I'm very worried we're going to hell in a handbasket, that things are getting really very dramatically worse on several very important fronts, which are all, of course, familiar. very rapidly increasing inequality and attendant social strains, an environmental catastrophe looming, things that have never really before occurred to humanity. And I think to an extent we are culturally trying to suffocate. And perhaps this fear, this anxiety is manifesting subconsciously in our culture of and the depictions of zombies, but that's a big claim to make. But somehow, I think that the future is pretty desperate and scary. I worry about the future for my little children. But that being said, we must imagine better futures. And what would that look like? I don't find thinking about dystopia and everything that's wrong very inspiring. In fact, I find it rather depressing, and I wouldn't go and listen to myself talking about it, let alone listening to anybody else. So it's important that we imagine a better future. I was at an event the other day where Muhammad Yunus, the founder of the Grameen Bank, which was this extraordinary bank that brought the idea of microcredit to Bangladesh and to the world, an empowering financial tool, he gave a speech to a group of people and made the point that science fiction gives us this view of the future, but it tends to be a depoliticized view of the future, a technological view of the future. What we need, he said, was a social science fiction, which is a perfectly awful phrase and a big turnoff. But you kind of get the point that he's after, that, you know, we haven't got a creative vision of possibility for society politically, economically. We just have the status quo and how it might sort of incrementally be improved. And that is pretty tedious and uninspiring. So with all of that introduction, I'm going to try to imagine what a better future might look like. And I've chosen this picture. An interesting genesis of this picture. I typed beautiful vista into the Google search engine, and that's what came up. So I thought, well, I wanted a beautiful vista, so that's what we've got. It is, in fact, a little town in Norway, which is a country I love, and if we all were like Norway, we wouldn't have any trouble at all. But unfortunately, we're not. Anyway, it's a beautiful vista. Why do I find that inspiring? Because my vision of the future is absolutely not a prescription. It is not a manifesto. It is not a blueprint. Partly it is that because I think all definite depictions of the future are, by their very nature, constraining. They limit us. They don't allow us the possibility of imagination. Thomas More's Utopia, I don't know how many of you have read that book, but its description of an ideal society is really a very dismal one. It doesn't sound like a fun place to be at all. And his depiction has, in fact, allowed utopian to become almost a kind of negative word for something that is ridiculous, something that is ludicrous and unfeasible. Oh, you're just being utopian. And so Thomas More has, in fact, in a sense, done a disservice to the idea of the future, of utopianism, of an ideal future. But in a sense, his problem is more specific, which is he actually describes his utopia. Because for me, the heart of my vision is about recapturing something that we have lost, which is agency, a sense of control over our own future, a sense of permission even to think about our own future. I'm rather more inspired, not by Thomas More, but by a mural in Tompkins Square Park, which some of you may know, where there is a rather bad picture of Joe Strummer, the lead singer of The Clash, and a quote saying, "The future is yet to be written." And I like Joe, and I'm another Englishman who loves this city, but I love that quote. I think it's great. The future is yet to be written. And that is a rather I rather prefer that description than Thomas More's more articulated vision. Because if my vision is of us retaking agency, of retaking control, then it is not for me to imagine it. I mean, I can imagine my own future and I can tell you about that if you really want. But actually, it is for you and us collectively to decide what that future should be. It is, in a sense, a blank canvas on which we are required to paint. How have we lost agency? Why this claim? It seems to me extraordinary that with all the progress that we've had, the extraordinary economic progress of the 20th century, the comforts and wealth that we now enjoy, in the Western world at least, that we should feel so constrained, that there seems to be a sort of collective crisis of feeling a lack of control, a lack of agency. How can we tell that we're suffering that crisis? Well, one signal to me is the subconscious fetishization of those who pretend that we have, in fact, control, that we have, in fact, an imagination. Why do we love the Apple Mac and its slogan, Think Different, so much? Why do we idolize the creator and founder of Apple Computer, Steve Jobs, to the extent that we do? An extraordinary idolization has taken place of this man. And I think it is partly to do with the fact that this product, a mere aluminium box, suggests to us that we can, in fact, think different. But our response, of course, is not to think different. It is to buy an Apple Mac, which is precisely the purpose, a rather cynical purpose, one might imagine, of the slogan. Because, in fact, we have denied ourselves the permission to think different. Another little psychic signal to me is what is happening in the workplace, where the oppression of the workplace is being reinvented for the 21st century, where the reality of coercion and hierarchy in the workplace, where your boss can literally remove your means of living and deny you healthcare at any moment, at a mere stroke. That is real power, that is real hierarchy, that is real coercion, and we live through it all the time at the office. We also live through what I think must be considerable tedium. Whatever you're making or thinking about or designing, the specialization required of the modern economy requires you to do it pretty much all the time. And however much you may have loved it at the beginning, once you've done it over and over again, whether it's designing computers or designing toothbrushes or selling cars or insurance, it's going to become pretty boring. It's pretty extraordinary that we've reached this sensation in the 21st century. But it is being recamouflaged for us. That reality is being recamouflaged for us by the means of design. But wearing jeans to work or bouncing on a... what are those bouncy balls called that you sit on? What are they called? I can't remember. One of those. Around the office and wearing T-shirts and having a bright smile on your face does not mean that that fundamental coercion and tedium has gone away. It is just being reconcealed. Another means of concealment is the awful terminology of management, of words like productivity and career, which are not real words, which don't really describe our real sensation, the real experience of what it is to be at work. Karl Marx, who I otherwise will not quote from, had a wonderful essay, apologies to those who came to my earlier talk, because I mentioned this then too. I hope this will be the only repetition. He wrote a wonderful essay called When the Human Becomes Animal, and I recommend it to you. Because he argues that anything that we're required to do that is other than what we would wish to do makes us less than human. And in the modern economy, just like the economy of the 19th century, a lot of us are required to do things a lot of the time that we wouldn't otherwise wish to do, namely showing up to work and doing boring things and being bossed around by people, you know, we do or don't respect. Marx went as far as to suggest that doing things that we didn't want to do, we wouldn't otherwise want to do, not only makes us inhuman, it turns us into something other than human. It makes us animals. Hence, when the human becomes animal. This is a rather colourful way of putting it, but the fundamental point is a clear one. But there are more practical constraints upon our freedom and our freedom to imagine the control, freedom to imagine our own futures, but also the control we have over our own lives. One very real constraint is that of debt, where those emerging into the marketplace, if they are to have any prospect of success in the modern economy, they must have degrees, which means they must have debt. Debt that continues from the moment they graduate, indeed starts long before they graduate, and may last an entire lifetime, requiring us to take choices that we wouldn't otherwise make, that when you graduate from college, you are impelled not to tour Europe with your easel or notebook or camera, but to get a job and to earn money and to earn a lot of money, as much money as you possibly can in order to pay off that horrible debt. And soon enough, you will have another debt, namely a mortgage, then the further debt of paying for your children through college, and on it goes. It is a very real constraint that we take for granted, but it is nonetheless a burden upon our freedom and our freedom to choose our own future. So we labour under this illusion. We pretend that we're free when in fact we're not, or in fact we barely are free. There may be one or two moments during life when one feels one has genuine agency, a freedom to choose. I had, I think, one or two of those moments, but they're not many. And for the poor, they're probably non-existent at all. So freedom has become a kind of illusion. So my vision is to recover that agency, that sense of control over our own circumstances. And that would permit us to explore the glorious vista of possibility. Don't think about what that actually is, a small town in Norway, but just think about it as a possibility, that a future where you might choose to launch rockets, farm goats, or construct giant sculptures to express the inexpressible, or you might devote your life to writing haikus or raising children. This is what freedom looks like. This is what possibility is, and you can each imagine what that possibility might be. It is an open, it is a four-dimensional space of physical space and time. It is not the tunnel we feel ourselves to be in for much of the time. It is infinite. And it is possible. This seems so ridiculous to say, and I even feel a kind of twinge of, God, they're going to think I'm ridiculous for even saying these things. And it having not said these things in public before, I am feeling a little bit, well, ridiculous. But it's not ridiculous, because it actually is totally possible. There is no reason economically why we are required endlessly to work on things that don't actually excite us very much. We have enough. The resources required to keep us fed, clothed, and housed, and our health properly looked after, are a very small proportion of the total economy, perhaps 5 or 10%, which begs the question what the hell the rest of us are doing. There's a wonderful chapter in Douglas Adams' book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Where he describes this planet that gets destroyed, and all the people of the planet have to go into giant spaceships to find a new planet to live on. And the entire population of the world that is destroyed is put into three spaceships. And one of them is all the engineers and farmers and doctors and people who actually do things that sustain us. That's one spaceship. And the truth is, that's the only spaceship that is guided to the new planet, because the other two, which is full of, you know, everybody else, are doing things that are entirely superfluous to the survival of the race. Anyway, it's much funnier when he writes it. But you get my point. So this is all the negative story, why we lack agency, that in fact we don't have to, you know, have, it doesn't have to be like this. We do actually have the means to have a richer imagination, a vista of possibility rather than of limits. But you would be absolutely right in saying, well, how the hell do you actually actualize that? How do you make this real? How do you emerge from our animalistic state? Well, I'm going to suggest there are three steps. Three is a good number. There are maybe more, but I'm going to offer you three. The first is actually to think different, to realize that the theoretical constraints of how we live, the theories of how we live, namely neoclassical economics, and indeed the theory of representative democracy, that we elect people to take decisions for us, that I would suggest you need to abandon those theories because they're based on very reductive views of what we are. These reductive views are incredibly powerful, and they suffuse almost everything in politics and in culture and indeed in our own discourse today. One, that we are nothing more than consumers, that we wish to maximize our utility in consumption, that we need to compete in order to maximize our growth. That is one reductive view. The other is that we're not capable of governing ourselves otherwise. Without government to keep us in order, we would all kill each other. As Hobbes argued, that there would be a war of all against all without Leviathan to keep us under control. I would suggest that you need to abandon those theories. And in fact, as we were discussing before, it might help to abandon all theory of how we are, of what we are, that anybody, including people like me, who come and tell you what humanity is and how it should order its affairs, should be safely and deliberately ignored. The second, in fact, this is still one. It's not the second thing yet. There are, in fact, alternative models that will actualize that, an alternative view of what humanity is. In the workplace, for instance, the conventional view of the profit-seeking company, which is owned by shareholders who demand ever greater sales, can be replaced by a model like a cooperative where actually everybody in the company shares agency, where everybody working there gets to decide what the future of the company should be and they share in its profits. There are companies like Mondragon in Spain and John Lewis, a highly successful retail chain in London, in Britain, that have shown that this works. And in Occupy, we are trying to set up a cooperative bank where everybody who uses its services will become a member of the cooperative and be able to decide the future of the bank. It's kind of a radical idea, but it's actually very simple and it's very basic, and there's no particular reason that it shouldn't work. One of the interesting curiosities, just as a side note, of attempting to set up such a thing is that legally it is extraordinarily difficult. And that is because banks have ensured that there is a vast barrier to entry established by federal legislation to anybody trying to do something as simple as what we're trying to do. The second way that one might alter that model is actually to start participating in the decisions of how we order our lives, actually to start demanding real decision-making power, and actually starting to manifest real decision-making power. Rather than voting for a politician to decide things for us, we can establish forums to decide things ourselves, whether in our workplace or at our local school or the places that most interest and concern us. This is called participatory democracy. It's a rather tedious polysyllabic phrase, but what it means is ordinary people taking part in decisions about the things that affect them. And it can work. It has worked in a city called Porto Alegre in Brazil, a 10-year experiment, the Porto Alegre experiment as it's called, of participatory democracy, where 50,000 people a year have participated in debates about how to spend the resources of the city. And in that 10 years, a World bank study has shown, the city has become a better place. Resources are more equitably distributed between the rich and poor. There used to be a highly wealthy centre, well serviced by roads, police, hospitals, and a much poorer periphery, the barrios. And that inequality has shifted thanks to participatory democracy. No surprise, because if everybody's involved in the decision of how to distribute resources, then it's no surprise that those resources will be distributed more equally to everybody. This is the outcome. Another interesting outcome was that party politics kind of ended in Porto Alegre, because suddenly people realized that, in fact, they weren't dealing with another party, they were just dealing with other people like them who had the same concerns as them. And if we sat down and had to decide the future of our local hospital, I think any labels that we walked in the door with, I'm a Democrat, you're a Republican, would rapidly seem rather specious and ridiculous, because we would just look each other in the eye and realize that we both needed our hospital and that we both had interests that were respectable, even if we didn't agree with one another, and we would see each other as real people. And Porto Alegre showed that this can actually work. It is actually practical. The idea that these participatory democracy is kind of ridiculous. You can't possibly decide things like that. You know, you can't have 50,000 people taking part in decisions. You can't have everybody decide everything. That's just ridiculous. Well, it's not ridiculous. It has actually worked. And it can work even here in America. And in fact, here in this city, in New York City, various city council members are beginning to use participatory decision-making systems to decide how to allocate the discretionary budget grants that they get for their neighborhoods. At the moment, I think 5 city council members are doing this, where they invite members of the neighborhood to come in and debate how this money that they get, a couple of million bucks, should be spent on the local school, on the roads, on the park, whatever. It's a kind of germ of participatory democracy. And of course, one thing it makes you wonder is how the hell is all the discretionary grants in the other council districts decided, where the people are not consulted on how it should be spent? Well, I think we can all take a wild guess at that. The second suggestion I would make about how to realize your glorious vista of possibility is actually to spend time imagining what it is you really want to do. This is a kind of awful, terrible existential question, and only once or twice in my life have I been forced to confront it. And it's a painful experience, it is a liberating one, but actually it doesn't need to be particularly difficult, because all you need to decide to do is what you're going to do in the next minute. You don't need to decide what to do in the for the rest of your life. And the sort of self-help industry that pretends this is just selling itself. Because all we have actual control over is what we do for the next minute. And if you start doing something different for the next minute about what you really want to do, then you've done something different. You have taken the first step towards your own personal emancipation and your ability to think of other possibilities. Because the other thing I think, and this is purely a personal subjective view, and you may absolutely be correct in disagreeing, is that imagining and thinking about your future and what it is you really want to do is tremendously difficult. And here, anarchism meets existentialism, that the act is the thing. We already have the freedom to think. It is the freedom to act that really matters, that one must act to start to fulfill one's own vision of the possible, or even the impossible. It is possible to be absurd, and that is as legitimate as being not absurd. But it is the act that matters, because that act embodies your choice, and in taking that act, other possibilities will emerge. I led a very constrained life for a long time as a government civil servant, which I was stupid enough to believe was a wonderful job, failing to attend to the sort of realities of my cognitive dissonance and my increasingly extreme behavior. But liberating myself from that felt like the liberation of leaving a straitjacket and being freed. But in fact, what I realized was that was only the first step. That act then led to another act, and then to another. And what this has become is this extraordinary journey. It sounds kind of cheesy, but it is a journey where literally I don't know where it's going to end. And that is a wonderful thing. One of the horrors of the contemporary culture is this idea of setting your ambition upon something. Your career should lead on this kind of ascending arc to this wonderful moment of fulfillment, of wealth, of power. It's a grotesque vision. It's a grotesque model, because actually not knowing, but simply deciding the next minute about trying to do something you really mind about, something you really like, is a much more real model of change, and actually one that makes us feel, well, actually, I could really do that. Rather than having to imagine everything, you can just imagine this little thing. Deng Xiaoping, the former Communist Party chairman, had a great line. I don't think he was applying it to a theory of self-liberation, but the slogan he had was crossing the river by feeling the stones, which I rather like. The third thing I'm going to suggest is actually what I've just said. Sorry, the taking the steps. This is my disorganization in my talk. I apologize for that. And I was going to make a slightly facetious point that this is, we could steal another sort of vacuous slogan from the commercial world, which is just do it. But anyway, it is a rather facetious point. Forgive me for it. That was my third step. Just do it. The thing is about all of this is if you take these three suggestions, then things actually will start to change. This is the extraordinary thing about it, that things will start to change for yourself, and as a result, they will start to change other people around you. Research indicates very clearly that the most powerful political influence upon us is not politicians, it is not scientists or experts, it is our neighbour, our friend, our brother, our husband, our wife. It is the people right next to us. They are the most profound influence upon us. And if you change your actions, you will change other people's. For it is, as the cliche goes, actions speak louder than words, or a better way of looking at it is the golden rule of all theatre, which is show, don't tell. So you'll change things. You'll change things for yourself, and you'll change things for the people around you, and eventually you might change things for everybody. Because indeed, of course, if we all did this, things would change dramatically. The world is but an aggregate of all of our little steps. It doesn't have these deeper forces, except perhaps the physical, the environmental, the atmospheric. It doesn't have these deeper forces, as is claimed by Marx or neoclassical economists. It doesn't have these deeper forces that shape it. It is unshapen. How the next minute shall be, or the next 100 years shall be, is utterly unknown. And anybody who tells you they know it is, I think, and I say this, you know, a little bit tentatively, because here I am making a claim about the future, but I think anybody who says that to you is entirely wrong. We are constrained by these theoretical models, this idea that there are these shapes and forms and patterns to existence that are immutable. And if we abandon that constraint, if we abandon those patterns and forms and ideologies, for that's what they are, neoclassical economics is an ideology about what we are as people. It is not an objective statement of fact. If we abandon those things, then a vista, a glorious vista of possibility becomes available. It does, however, require one thing, which is to act. And on that note, I would like to conclude. Thank you.
So I just wanted to invite anyone who has questions to come down and speak into the microphone so that we can capture this on the recording. Does anyone have a question?
Hi, a long way for a short question. Could you talk more about the bank?
Oh, the bank. Yeah, sure. The idea was started in Zuccotti Park. I mean, one of the great things about Occupy was it gave permission for people to do things. And I loved it for that. There was a really sense of liberation down there in Zuccotti Park. There were a lot of people who suddenly felt that they had permission to do things about things they really cared about. And there was a group of us who decided that the thing we wanted to do was about banking, because banking was clearly at the heart of the problem. A group of us started meeting, and we started talking about what would a better bank look like, one that wasn't closed, transparent, egregiously profiteering, risking the entire economy, blah, 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 you know all that. But what would a better one look like? And we debated that for a long time, and the group got smaller. But actually, after, 15 months now, we're now in the process of incorporating a cooperative financial services company. We're not allowed to call it a bank because we're not able to take deposits or make loans, not yet. But it will offer financial products. And I think, touch wood, that this thing's actually going to happen. So I think you will, I hope, hear about the Occupy Money Cooperative, as it's called. If you don't hear about it, then we will have failed. But I think it's actually going to happen. And I hope that it will, and we have the first financial product lined up. I can't say what it is because it's supposed to be a surprise. But we have the first financial product lined up, and it's pretty good. It's actually a thing that is better than what's out there now. It's cheaper, it's more transparent, it treats the customer better, blah, blah, blah. I actually think this time it's really going to happen. It's a little thing, and it was a kind of real instruction for me in my own kind of rhetoric that actually it is little people and people just showing up week after week to sometimes quite boring and antagonistic meetings that actually gets you there. You have to keep showing up. You have to keep taking the steps. It does not happen on its own. And one of the interesting things about it was the first meeting, I had left a sign-up sheet in Zuccotti Park and I emailed everybody and said, look, I'm going to have the first meeting. And about 90 people showed up. And everybody wanted to give their little speech about what was wrong. And it took quite a while to get through all the little speeches. And the next week, 20 people showed up, which said to me that people have a lot to say about it. And over the ensuing time, the group got even smaller, which maybe says something about activism, maybe says something about those of us who are left in the group. I don't know. But it was quite striking. And the people who are making this thing happen, there's one man in particular who is making this thing happen, whose name is a secret because he works for a bank and he would lose his job if it were known who he is. He is about the last person you would think of who was an Occupy. If you met him on the street, you'd think, oh, you know, he's a trader, you know, an uber capitalist, or was, who is disgusted by what he has seen in Wall Street and wants to make something better. And this is a way of manifesting his political feelings of actually creating something, not just, I mean, I don't think he attended a single Occupy demonstration because that just wasn't his thing. But what his thing is building something. And this man has worked extraordinarily hard over the last 15 months to make this thing a reality. And if it happens, it will be very largely because of him. Anyway, that's what's going on with the bank. Yes? Sorry, you have to trot down here and deliver your... Oh, hello.
I just have two questions. You talked about participatory democracy, that it's a myth, that it can't scale up, that it can work with 50,000 people, and you mentioned the place in Brazil. I was wondering if you can flesh that out more, because I remember that, I was in Occupy, and I remember that being a big bone of contention, people saying that, you know, a GA is great for Zuccotti, but it can't scale up. Then my second question, you mentioned Hobbes, the short, brutish, nasty life underlying all of our life, and I've often thought that there were two...
Yeah.
That's actually suffused as much of in society too. So I was wondering if you can speak, because you meant English.
Sure. I'll take on Hobbes and Rousseau. The first question, scalability. One of the problems with GA in Occupy and the Spokes Council, can people hear me? The first question was about Occupy and the problems of... it is on, sorry. I thought it wasn't working. One of the problems of GA in Occupy was that it was trying to decide a single agenda. A lot of time was spent trying to decide what Occupy should do, its manifesto, its list of demands, and what its actions should be. And I think that was always a doomed venture for a group of people who had very diverse views about things and very diverse concerns. And I think that's okay in that context to have diverse concerns and views, because reforming the current dispensation is a task of many approaches, not one. And I think the success will mean launching 1,000 ships against the enemy, and maybe 20 of them will get through. But it's going to take all of that diversity of approach to be successful. It is, you know, the modern dispensation of capitalism and representative democracy is manifested in so many ways. But the other thing I would say about it is that models of participatory democracy were not very well understood in Occupy. There wasn't a lot of people who really knew practically how to make it work, and GA was a very imperfect thing. The idea of reaching consensus in 500 people in the park was kind of ridiculous, where one person could just stop anything. And of course, that just encouraged people to just stop things just for the hell of it. So I think there are much better models about using a staged approach to consensus building, which were not implemented. And you know, part of this is a cultural change of us learning about these alternative models and getting used to them. Because one of the strange things I found in our working group was that culturally everybody wanted to argue. As soon as somebody put forward a view, the kind of atmosphere of aggression arrived very quickly, because people are so used to politics being about I want this and you want that and I'm right and you're wrong, you know, very, very confrontational, antagonistic model of politics, which is of course what we see every day in Washington, when in fact participatory approaches are very much more about listening to other people, trying to construct options which satisfy their interests as well as yours. Which is a very different approach. Now, I'm not saying it's all kind of lily-livered and let's be nice, but what James Fishkin, a professor in Stanford, has discovered, that if you give people real decisions, you put a group of people in a room, if you ask them to debate the future of gun control, they're going to argue. But if you give them a real decision that really matters to them, where they actually have agency, where it is that group of people who are going to decide the future of their local school, the dynamic changes completely. People listen to each other because they know that if they fail to reach agreement, they've got a problem. The culture, the atmosphere of politics changes. And this is what happened in Porto Alegre, that the whole culture of politics was altered. Unfortunately, it didn't last because the national parties kind of stamped it down. But it did work, and the metrics proved it. So it is scalable, but it will take us time to learn it. The second question, Hobbes versus Rousseau. I mean, I think what's interesting about both of them is they both have a very singular view of the human. You know, one takes a more negative view, one takes a more positive view. And what I'm saying is that we shouldn't take any view. I don't know what that view should be. I mean, I don't know whether people are intrinsically good or intrinsically bad. Perhaps they're not intrinsically anything. From what I've seen, including being involved in an illegal war, which is a pretty terrible thing, you put people in the right circumstances and they'll do pretty much bloody anything. Even very good people. One of the very, very distressing and disillusioning things for me was seeing my colleagues and my friends go along with something that they knew to be wrong and they knew to be a lie. And of course that echoes more extreme histories like what happened during the Second World War, where historians like Christopher Browning have shown that the Holocaust and mass atrocities were sometimes and often committed by very ordinary people, not kind of wild-eyed SS men, but units raised from quiet country towns composed of doctors and farmers and postmen who all knew each other. And this particular unit that he described, Police Battalion 101, which is the title of his book, killed 140,000 people, a battalion of a couple of hundred men. They shot Jews, 140,000 people, at close range with rifles. And interestingly, Browning says, they were actually given the choice not to do it. And there were actually moments where their commanding officers said, if you don't want to do this, you can step back. And very few of them took that choice. It doesn't say things about Germans. It says about what we will do in the right circumstances, in the right structures, and where culture permits it. I think if you change the structures of how we interact with each other to be less based on power, where power is shared, and where everybody's voice matters, because I think what we want to feel in life is that we actually matter, amongst other things, I think you will get better behavior. That's kind of a wish. I can't guarantee it, and it may be wrong. We may have a war of all against all if you do what I suggest, but I don't think so. And I actually think the current way of doing things, of coercive power keeping us in line, is itself horrific through, you know, the effects of the system of crime and punishment, of punishment and justice, supposed justice, but also the effects on our world. The current system that's supposed to be creating order is in fact promoting disorder, and that we need a radically different approach, and we certainly need to abandon Hobbes. Leviathan was written during the English Civil Wars, which was a period of terrible chaos. Is it perhaps any surprise that he wrote a book about the necessity of overweening authority to create order and stability in society at a time like that? Rousseau is more complicated, but, well, I could say a lot about that, but I will probably sound boring. Sure, please.
What do you think about libertarianism and, I guess, limited government, how that would give us freedom, and why don't you think the Occupy movement ever joined with that? And also, what do you know about anarchist capitalism?
Yeah, well, anarcho-capitalism and libertarianism, you know, in a sense, are the same strain. I mean, it's very difficult talking about these ideologies because they are such broad phenomena, there's such broad churches. I mean, anarchism, you know, is often depicted as being violent nihilists, kind of, you know, storming barricades or people who shot the president. You know, my kind of anarchism, my kind of libertarianism is of a much more peaceful and collective kind, and collegial, collaborative, lots of other words like that. Libertarianism seems to me, to an extent, to emphasize the individual too much. But that is not to do its more sophisticated thinkers a justice. In my book, I discuss a guy called Max Stirner, who's a German anarchist, and in many ways the kind of arch-libertarian, who believes that we have no other duty except to express our own desires and interests as powerfully as we wish. We have nothing, no other obligations to each other. I would, of course, say we have obligations to each other, to listen to one another, to take the other's interests into account if we are to succeed, because we need each other and there is no choice. But in fact, if you look at Stirner's philosophy, in a way he's saying the same thing. If you are actually only compelled to express your own interests, you're only obliged to do that, at some point you are going to have to negotiate with other people around you. And it is in your interest to do that peacefully and collaboratively. So in a sense, he's saying something very true, and I respect that. And I actually have a lot more respect for that than I have for people giving moral lectures about how we should behave, because I don't think they work. I mean, there's a philosopher called Peter Singer, if some of you probably know, who's argued that we should all donate 5% of our income to help the poor, which I think is a wonderful idea, and there's nothing wrong with the idea. But for some reason, it's not working. It hasn't taken off as an idea. And I think that may be because of this issue of proximity, that if we're dealing with each other, if there is a child starving in front of me, I'm going to help that child. If it is 1,000 miles distant, I'm not going to help that child. And I do think one of the things I'm talking about is engagement about everything. This idea of disembodied action, voting, protesting, asking others to reform, giving money, signing a petition, I'm profoundly hostile to that idea that we need to embody our own political desires by action. And if you want to do something about poverty, I'm not saying go to Somalia and, you know, eat food that otherwise would go to starving people, but, you know, meet Somalis. They are very real people. They have very real interests. They're, you know, not just like you and me, but they have a deeply sophisticated and articulate view of their needs. And, you know, I just think that is a more powerful way to stimulate your own engagement, for that engagement to be more satisfying. There's something deeply dissatisfying about just making a donation. And I'm not, you know, saying Singer's wrong to demand or to argue what he's arguing. Morally, he's right. But he's not convincing the world, is he? And I think it's because we're trapped in this very disembodied view of action. So in a sense, I'm more with Stirner than I am with Singer. It's a long answer, partly because I'm troubled by the way libertarianism is talked about in this country, and that it is the preserve of the right, and you know, to be anti-government is to be a Republican, you know. But I think actually the left, the progressives, have a lot to learn, because if you think about government, in many ways it is not working here at all, and it's not because it's corrupt and bureaucratic and it's just wrong in itself. It's you know, the outcomes of it are just not good outcomes. The system of punishment is a grotesque monstrosity. You know, we have a very violent society, despite you know, the policing and the laws that we have. We have a very unequal society. I think I've made my point. I think there can be a progressive anarchism, there can be a progressive libertarianism about just doing things for ourselves and following our political wishes, whatever they are, to wherever they lead us. And that was one of the things in Occupy that was very interesting. There weren't many people, I felt, demanding, saying, we need to go to Washington and demand that they do this, this, and this. There was some of that. There was a lot more of, you know, we need to go and do things. And Occupy, to those still doing Occupy, and there's several, a lot of groups across the city, I don't know, perhaps you're part of one, but who are actually moving to a phase of actually setting things up. Occupy Sandy, practical action to help Sandy victims. Strike debt, practical action to help those, you know, punished by debt, who are now thinking of very interesting ideas of setting up collectives of debtors to take on the banks. You know, very practical things. Was there another question? Was libertarianism, Yeah, I think it's kind of the same thing, yeah. Yeah.
Just to kind of follow up to parts of the last answer and maybe three answers before about kind of global scalability and I mean, I understand like Occupy Sandy or you know, the power of being face to face and understanding people in your community or even scaling up to the city level. But when you're kind of talking about you know, Somalia or whatever, and you can either give 5% of your income, send money there, or you can go to Somalia and have a kind of empathetic relationship face to face. You know, one at least is transferring wealth; the other seems dependent on you know, just personal action to establish empathy and so on, and kind of what. How do you scale to kind of actually, if not wealth transfer from rich countries to poor countries, you know, just these kind of global inequalities within the model you're proposing?
I think that's a really important question and criticism of an anarchistic approach, of a, you know, horizontal movement-based approach. But I would suggest the current way of doing things internationally is not working terribly well. You know, having been in a big government, having watched the UN at work and watching it now, including on issues like Somalia, I think it's not a... It's neither flexible, it's not responsive to the needs of local people, certainly what's going on now in Somalia. And it's certainly not dealing with global problems like climate change, transboundary phenomena of economic volatility or terrorism. And I think that's because there's a category mismatch between an international system of nation states and international phenomena, transnational phenomena, which are not nation states. They're not national, they're international. And so we have a kind of, a profound kind of mismatch of the tool and the problem. So I would start by saying I don't think that system is working very well. I'm not saying let's, you know, dynamite the UN. I do think all of these changes need to be gradual. But what I do see is the emergence of global movements to address particular problems, which is very exciting to me. The global human rights movement, for instance, over the last 50 years has made human rights an issue as it never was in the early 20th century. Similar things are happening on the environment. And one of the interesting things that I'm seeing is these movements starting to become not movements of campaigning and protest, but movements of action. So there's a group called The Rules, which is trying to change rules around taxation and banking safe havens in a very practical manner, country to country, but is a global movement. And I think people are beginning to get it, that appealing to governments and the UN and stuff is not only very unsatisfactory as an activity personally, but is not terribly, you know, the amount of energy they're putting in is not commensurate with the result they're getting. And actually, you know, doing something more practical, including the establishment of normative standards, you know, in things like fisheries, forests, the management of those things. Normative standards, standard setting is emerging as a powerful global tool. I'm not saying it's the whole answer to the problem of scalability, but I personally think if we adopted this approach, we'd have a better crack at solving these problems than the way we're doing it now. I mean, on the climate, for instance, which scares the hell out of me, we follow climate very closely in Independent Diplomat. We're advising some of the Pacific Island states, which are already being inundated. In the Marshall Islands today, there is a terrible drought. People are suffering terribly. They never had drought there before. And we're helping them in the UN climate change negotiations. I think there is no chance of a legally binding global treaty to limit carbon emissions that will actually lower carbon emissions. I don't think that's possible. And yet the international system is still configured to aim for that. So I think we have to say it's not working. What would work better? You have to go to the mic. Sorry. Sure.
What are your thoughts on experience as currency if and when a civilization ever approaches a singularity, and what will that mean for a hive mind?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Could you perhaps tell it to me in another way so I can understand it?
Okay. The singularity, do you know what that is?
I think so, yes.
Well, if and when a civilization were to approach or be in the singularity, do you think that it's possible that being in a hive mind of that kind, if we integrate into the singularity, it would be possible that individual experience could become a currency and a sort of barter and trade system unto itself?
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting idea.
If not a currency.
Oh, it's an extraordinary idea. I'd need to think about my answer to that, because I mean, I think the truth is I don't really know. I have to say I'm a little bit sceptical of the idea of the singularity of this moment. For those of you who don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's this idea that computing power will advance at such a rate that eventually it will overtake human intelligence and will advance on its own, solving many problems sort of ipso facto on its own. Is that correct?
Well, what I was talking about was more along the lines of computing reaching past human capacity, but also that people actually like sort of like grabbing onto that as it's going up.
Sure.
So that
sure.
you actually become entrained with other human beings.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we're in the realm of speculation. It is a something I'm certainly happy to do. I don't know the answer. I think to perhaps give you a slightly more banal answer, which isn't, you know, respecting the imagination of the question, but I am quite skeptical of technology as the savior.
I agree with you, actually.
And I think that unless it is understood in a deeply political way and practiced in a deeply political way and not presented as an apolitical phenomenon that is intrinsically good, where, you know, it is as likely to be a tool of inequality and oppression as it is a tool for good.
If free will even survives it.
If there is such a thing in any case.
Good point.
We should share our experience in the hive mind.
That sounds dirty.
Okay, we've run. Oh my goodness. That's extraordinary. What are you guys doing here?
We are part of a culture club. We are here randomly.
These are my son's teachers. Who are the most heroic and wonderful people. They work at a special school in Manhattan for autistic children. And if we were making statues in the future, it should be to them. It's true. Hello. What a joy to see you.
Bye.
Bye. That's bizarre.
Just building on the discussion we had at 2:00, in terms of little things that individuals can do to combat instead of the standard environmental activism, what are the kinds of things you might recommend or to do to deal with it? I mean, what I've been doing, you know, getting people to sign petitions, that kind of thing, attending rallies, doesn't really seem to do very much. And I just wondered what you would recommend to someone. Thank you.
Well, I mean, you've obviously come to the same conclusion I have. I don't have anything to recommend to you. What I had to say is that it is for you to find that out. I mean, that sounds rather awful and unhelpful, but cracking this nut is a huge task and a difficult one, and it will require, you know, lots of intelligent people thinking about it and trying different things. And all I would say is, you know, direct yourself to that task single-mindedly and measure your effect by the actual outcome of actually reducing the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. There's a very interesting thing that Yale University undergraduates are doing where they make a commitment to decarbonizing their lifestyle by 8% a year, which seems to be a number that would actually, if we all did it, would actually, you know, keep us at a beneath the danger 2 degrees centigrade level of global temperature rise. And that's quite an interesting thing of actually people making commitments that to do that. And there are very practical ways listed about how you can do that. Some of them involve, you know, air travel, which is a huge contribution that we can avoid. But there are other practical things listed on their site. I think it's on a public site, where if you make a commitment, you encourage others to make a commitment, and you kind of police each other, like the panopticon of Francis Bacon, which is a model I kind of like, of peer review of our own commitments. So that's perhaps something I could suggest. Anyway, I think we're wrapping up now. Thank you, Sarah. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for a really rich, interesting discussion. Thanks a lot.